Welcome to the Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I am the guest host for the week, Peter Weinberger. Our regular Peace Frequency host, Darren Cambridge, is in the Big Easy, New Orleans, at the annual International Studies Association Conference. My co-host for today's show is Dr. Anthony Wanyi St. John. He is the main instructor and author of the online course, Negotiation, Shaping the Conflict Landscape, which the Global Campus has been offering during the month of February. Anthony is joining us live. Anthony, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Peter. Great to be here, although I kind of wish I was in the Big Easy, given how cold it is in D.C. this week.
This week in the negotiation course, we have been looking at tactical moves in negotiation, distinguishing between the process and substance of a negotiation, how to approach stalemates in a negotiation, articulating how an agreement reached through negotiation will be implemented, and the pros and cons of negotiating in teams. In that vein, we're introducing our guest for today, Mr. Jesse Pruitt. Jesse Pruitt is a veteran of nearly 20 years of military and government service, including multiple tours to Afghanistan and Iraq, and service abroad in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Bosnia. He is the recipient of the Samuel L. Sharp Award for Creative Work in International Relations at the graduate level from the School of International Service at American University. Mr. Pruitt has been a guest lecturer at the Inter-American Defense College, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and George Mason University. His written works have appeared in Military Review, Special Warfare, numerous Center for Army Lessons Learned publication, and the volumes Countering Insurgency and Promoting Democracy, as well as American Strategy and Purpose, Reflections on Foreign Policy and National Security in an Era of Change. He is a member of the Council for Emerging National Security Affairs and a distinguished member of the U.S. Army Civil Affairs Corps. When not in uniform, Mr. Pruitt supports the Department of Army staff at the Pentagon and continues to serve as a U.S. Army Reserve paratrooper. He resides in Alexandria, Virginia. Our guest, Mr. Pruitt, is speaking on his own behalf and not on behalf of the U.S. Army or the U.S. government. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, one of the themes for the course during this week is the notion of the relationship platform and how a particular relationship between counterparts affects the negotiation process. One aspect of this idea relates to hierarchy and hierarchical organizations, such as the military. You've had a long and distinguished military career, and we know that military forces are always organized on hierarchical lines, with ranks for each individual to let them know where they stand in that hierarchy, and to establish lines of upward and downward authority and accountability. So do soldiers, airmen, and sailors ever have to negotiate their orders, as Colonel Steve Donaldson, our last Peace Frequency guest, asserted? What has changed in the missions of the U.S. military that might impact this?
Peter, I think that there's a spectrum that sort of comes into play, and of course every instance would be different, but there's actually a confluence of various spectrums that would come to play for any particular instance. So the type of operation that the military unit is involved in, if it's a peacekeeping operation, that'd be very different than if it's a direct conflict. If it's a stability operation, that would be different than counterterrorism operations, for example. So the flexibility that a subordinate might have to engage regarding an order depends on that environment. And it also depends on the relationship and the rank of the individuals involved. If you're a brand new infantry soldier in basic training, your latitude is very little. If, however, you're a seasoned veteran of 20 years and you are engaging with your superior about an order, you might be given a greater latitude to sort of voice an opinion, to challenge some assumptions that may have predicated that order. But at the end of the day, after the discussions, after the negotiations, when the order is delivered, you must execute that order. Now, the second part of the question was the sort of potential impact of a changing environment. And I think that we have seen that in recent years. The military, you know, I guess if you look at popular films and myths, you see that, you know, perhaps if you were in Gettysburg and there was not much room for ambiguity in the nature of the mission, therefore in the nature of the orders, and therefore in your ability to negotiate those orders. Take the hill is take the hill. Mm-hmm. However, in a stability operation environment, there's a lot more ambiguity. So the order may not have as much clarity or definition, which begs for some additional negotiation or discussion between the subordinate and the leader.
I want to build on something that you wrote a few years back that I thought tied into this theme a little bit. In one of your 2011 publications that appeared in the Army and Interagency Operations newsletter, you commented that the U.S. Army Counterinsurgency Field Manual sought a, I'm going to quote this now, holistic approach that leverages critical elements of society to look beyond a defeated enemy and achieve a more comprehensive victory. Could you tell us what some of the critical elements of society could be in this different kind of warfare and what that more comprehensive victory means to you? Flesh it out a little bit, because I think it'll serve as the basis for ongoing discussion today. And what does that mean? What does this phrase mean for our civilians and military, for example, who are still in Afghanistan today?
So I think the most obvious manifestation of that, those critical elements of society, is the three Ds, right? That's the defense, diplomacy, development sort of nexus that has been in vogue for the past decade or so. But I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. Certainly within the military doctrinal approach, there's military loves acronym. This acronym is DIME, which is diplomatic, information, military, and economic, right? Bringing to bear all of those functions of government to address a particular issue, problem, topic, to influence the situation in a certain way. So, but beyond the acronyms, right, you know, then of course there's the interagency, right, which, you know, people like to use it as if it's a capital I, but it really isn't.
There's no entity, right?
There's no interagency that you can't call the interagency, right? You know,
can't pick up the phone and call the interagency.
Exactly. So there's, but, you know, any particular set of problems or as a discrete problem may have an interagency assigned to it, a group of folks from various entities that come together to address that particular problem. And that becomes, within that context, the interagency.
Right.
But really, it is any facet of, in this case, government or government function that is brought to bear on a particular issue. But I think one thing that may be lost on the ground on a more tactical level is the role of civil society. Mm. And I think that, you know, we talk about how does government address the problem, but really how do populations, and how can we support populations to address those problems at a local level is an element that I don't know is always captured mm-hmm. as fully as some of the others are captured. And I think that that's a critical element when you talk about the elements of society that need to come together. It's not just what can government do, certainly not just what the military can do, but what can how can the population be empowered mm-hmm. to start, you know, kind of at the grassroots, bottom up level, to address those problems on its own.
Their problems in their own society.
Exactly.
That got them to whatever conflict they're in involved in. Okay. And the more comprehensive victory. Because that's the second important part of that phrase in your publication that I thought was very critical and, you know, full of potential.
So when I think of comprehensive victory, and I know that the parallels are It's not a good parallel to today's conflicts, but you know, the aftermath of World War II really sort of demonstrated what a more comprehensive victory might mean.
Right.
After the guns are put down, then what happens? And of course, again, it's not a good parallel, but it does help define what a comprehensive victory might mean. Whereas the whole society is reinvigorated. And now you see that the countries of Germany and Japan are vibrant, healthy societies when they were completely decimated in a military sense.
Right.
And the United States helped to do that, helped to set the conditions for them to reemerge.
Stabilize, to reconstruct.
Exactly.
And to emerge as non-belligerent societies, not intent on dominating their neighbors. And
exactly. So the role that we can play in sort of fostering that type of resurgence, I think that that's where you would see a comprehensive victory, one that is not defined by the
defeat of the military forces only,
by the cessation of hostilities, uh-huh. or a surrender, a white flag, but rather what happens after the guns are not the main player.
Right. I'd like to follow up on that point. It's very interesting. You mentioned the crucial role that civil society plays in that regard. In my own experience and working in post-conflict countries, I've observed that in the absence of an occupying power or absence of a functioning government, civil society is crucial. But the way that local people define civil society is often understood quite differently than outside interveners understand civil society. And in some places, what we might consider civil society is non-existent, but what local people consider civil society are things like tribal elders or clan-based groups, and working with them in a functional type arrangement or reaching agreements with them is exceedingly complex. So I'm wondering, based on your experiences, how your initial thoughts about the civil society that you were working with met the reality on the ground? Were you able to square the circle, so to speak?
Well, as you identify, each situation is quite unique. I think in Afghanistan, from my experience and in my imagination, I can't imagine a society that might be further removed from our own as far as its framework, its touch points, the frames of reference that it has. A lot of people in the mid-2000s would say, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, they're pretty much the same. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Iraq had a very functioning level of government, as corrupt as it was. And, you know, in the 70s, they were a vibrant player on the world stage, and, you know, jet setters would go there for vacations, and they certainly understood the concepts that were being discussed. Their middle class was well educated in a Western sense. And so when you were discussing policies and procedures and ways that you might bring a society forward, the people you were engaged with would at least understand the language you were speaking, not the English, but the terminology,
the concepts.
Right. Whereas in Afghanistan, these are completely foreign concepts. A vote, democracy, they'd never heard these terms before, especially outside of Kabul. The nation itself never really functioned as a nation. It was really, as you've mentioned, tribal fiefdoms that were loosely collected and that had a greater affinity to perhaps tribes on the other side of another border than they did to Kabul, even though they happened to be within that boundary. So it really, and then of course, Central America, you know, is a different thing, and Bosnia is a different thing. So I don't know that there's really a template that you can say, okay, well, if we study this template, we take this someplace, we'll be able to put this template down and civil society will take root. I think it really just depends on applying a cultural lens to whatever sort of goal we are seeking to achieve, and then ensuring that our goals are realistic and measured, as opposed to sort of grandiose Western-style democracy will emerge wherever we send our representatives.
Yeah, there's much wisdom to what you say, and my colleagues and I at USIP have observed that a lot of times modular approaches to complex problems don't work out easily in the real world. That's well said. I wanted to return to some of the themes that Anthony talked about in his last question, particularly about interagency collaboration, because of your expertise and willing to bring that to light in a discussion about negotiation. Anthony in the class discussed the notion of sort of taking stock and confirming the agenda. And that's something that's often easier said than done, even in the same government or the same organization, because people have different agendas. And they might even have different agendas after a negotiation has been concluded. And since you share an interest in the interagency collaboration, whether it's dealing with natural disasters or political instability or warfare, we wanted to hear from you. Also, because we mentioned, you served in Afghanistan on a provincial reconstruction team and civil affairs in other countries. You published a few years ago a provocative piece called The Sound of One Hand Clapping, very Zen idea, and that was in the Simon Center Interagency Newsletter at Fort Leavenworth. And in it, you promoted the idea of better interagency integration. So I'm wondering if you could comment on this Zen notion of, or lack of perhaps, of Zen notion of interagency integration and what that means really from a negotiation point of view.
What the title was attempting to capture is the effectiveness of one party going it alone. I guess in most cases that is the Department of Defense. That's not true. I guess the appearance is that it is the Department of Defense going alone, because it is oftentimes the most visible actor, and certainly it has the largest footprint of the U.S. government's actors when it is abroad. So if there is a reliance, or there is even the perception that, well, the Department of Defense has that, whatever that is outside of warfighting, then that's a mistaken assumption, and it's a mistaken approach that is bound to lead to a disappointing outcome. And the Department of Defense itself has said on numerous occasions that, hey, after the warfighting's done, we need help. Right? We're not the ones that can deliver the solution. If there is a solution to be found, it must be garnered from all of these other actors. And so facilitating mechanisms that sort of bring that concept of these actors together, that's where I think the future lies, especially as we move away from Iraq and Afghanistan, which were probably not going to be the models for how future activities are conducted abroad. A construct, particularly at the sort of expeditionary, operational, tactical levels, not the strategic stuff, although that's important, that's sort of set the stage, but there's a list, a litany of these various efforts that have taken place from all the different, from the executive to State Department to Department of Defense, all these high level initiatives that have been since 2000, that have even before then, they've been implemented, they've been passed. This is what's going to
be the new
fix the thing, but it ends up rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, right? Because at the end of the day, that common agreement at the highest levels that, yes, we really need to bring this interagency together and do something, doesn't translate necessarily to how it is applied on the ground. And that's where I think we need to apply some effort to sort of develop a fix of, well, how are we going to do that? If everyone's in agreement that that's a good idea, then what are we doing to actually realize that?
If we're not talking about, the National Security Council as an interagency coordinator, but talking about the real expeditionary in the field moments of cooperation between civilian U.S. government agencies and U.S. military forces, isn't that in a microcosm what the PRTs were that you've served on, that you've written about and reflected on? Were the PRTs, can they be considered interagency cooperation in the zone of conflict?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that numbers of studies have been done to look at how the PRTs were successful and what were their failures, their shortcomings. But the concept of bringing folks together with these various levels of expertise that one agency cannot be expected to maintain on their own, that strikes me as just a intuitively mm-hmm. positive approach.
Right.
How we get to the thing on the ground from the high-level strategic sort of
the concept
the concept, that's where the gap is, right? So in some cases, the PRTs were very successful and effective. In some cases, they were not. But largely, whether they were or were not was happenstance. And then personalities happened to fall together in a situation where they could apply and meet with some success. In other cases, that they weren't. And that's some of the things that I've written about was, identifying that there was not a program in place to create conditions for success for the PRTs.
Right.
It was a concept, and then they just threw bodies at it. And then sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
Were there a lot of negotiations within PRTs, say between agriculture and the PRT commander or other civilian agencies trying to promote their agenda and the battalion or brigade that they were attached to or embedded within?
Well, absolutely. And I think, that there, first of all, there are quite a few different manifestations of PRT. We're talking about PRT as if it were a single sort of entity, but mm-hmm. there were vastly different models of the PRT. There was an Iraq model, there was an Afghanistan model. Within Iraq, there was the regular PRT, and then there was the EPRT, the embedded version. Some PRTs were led by Department of State, some PRTs were led by Department of Defense. But then there were also a number of coalition country PRTs, each of which brought their own models.
The Germans had PRT.
Exactly. The various coalition countries had a PRT, and they would conduct their operations with their own, unique flair.
Right.
So you have this broad spectrum of PRTs. I think that's one of the problems that with the PRT brand for the population that we are, trying to reach within those countries is that, if I go to a PRT in this province, I encounter a certain set of circumstances, but my cousin in another province goes to a PRT and encounters a vastly different set of circumstances. That PRT does X and Y. This PRT only does Z and won't touch X and Y.
Right.
And this PRT is very militaristic, and this PRT is very soft, kind of focused, more on humanitarian things. So really, what am I getting from a PRT if I'm a citizen and I don't really understand what it's supposed to be?
Sounds like it's different in each and every case.
Absolutely, and a part of that goes back to the preparation and the staffing.
Right. Right?
There was no sort of universal PRT. Training program that brought those that were going to be serving together before they went over, and so that they were starting from the same place and the same set of understanding of criteria of what the PRT was attempting to accomplish and how it would accomplish things, what resources it would have at its disposal. Now, of course, the counterargument to that is that, well, each province is different.
Got so its own different.
So
context
the PRT
needs.
Construct and the PRT makeup should be different. And of course, there's some truth to that. But my criticism, I guess, would be that there wasn't a thoughtful methodology to apply any sort of standard to say that, well, in this is a highly agricultural province, so we need more representation
people.
From the Department of Agriculture.
Nobody said that would be an a template for setting them up or standing them up.
Exactly. Mm.
I've got a little follow-up here because something I've learned from you over the years in our discussions is not only about the kind and intensity, the number of negotiations across military and civilian partners in working together in a zone of conflict, but also between, for example, the military, U.S. military in particular, and let's say international humanitarian agencies, foreign or local NGOs. And a few years ago, you created for me a very memorable simulation that I still use, that I use here at USIP, that juxtaposes a unit of corpsmen, I think they were Marines in the simulation that you created, with a European or international NGO also doing humanitarian medical stuff, and then the UN. And those three roles come together, and none of them have everything needed for the job to be done in that zone. And they also don't have relationships with each other that are deep or good. And I wonder if that simulation was based on real experiences that you've had, because you certainly set up a really good problem that my students always have to struggle to resolve in the actual simulation. Can you tell us a little bit about experiences that helped you create that case?
Yeah, that is based on a personal experience. On a deployment that we had, there was an international NGO that did not, its policy prohibited it from interacting with militaries, and the personalities prohibited it from really appreciating American contributions.
So there was an anti-American sort of attitude among the folks in that organization.
Yes, there was, right. And they were running a local clinic, and then, you know, as the U.S. military there, we had some medical supplies that you know we were hopeful would have some benefit in the local area, and then of course the United Nations was there sort of as the honest broker, the intermediary,
right?
And we were able to work through the UN representatives and identify a place to sort of drop the medical supplies, and they would be stumbled upon by the international NGO who would just happen to find these medical supplies lying out in the field, and then they would take them back to the clinic and be able to use them. And uh-huh. So sort of, you know, the old Truman quote of you can accomplish many things if you don't care who gets the credit.
Right.
So we just wanted the wheelchairs to be put to good use, and they could put them to good use. We couldn't, and they didn't want them to be from the U.S., so we just pretended like they weren't from us.
So. Yeah, yeah. So lots of different kinds of solutions to those sort of problems. That was the one in that actual instance. As people do the role play you created, they often, you know, come up with really out of the box ideas. They decide to partner up with the NGO, but rebadge, repaint vehicles, because the Medical Mercy Mission, the fictional NGO, has no vehicles, but they know where the population that's in need of these supplies is. They're actually desperate for security, but they don't want to be hiding behind American military in uniform. So they find some compromise on that. The UN neither has the patients nor the medications, but they have legitimacy, so they provide the front sort of branding of the whole initiative. So there are lots of ways that people, you know, take the problem that you faced in the field and start thinking about how to grapple with it. Were they in it themselves? There's since you and I have collaborated on creating negotiation training materials, I've thought a little bit about what there is out there in the world of negotiation training for U.S. military. And I know a couple of pockets of it. You've brought me to work with civil affairs folks here and there, here in this region. I see that the special operations community has some negotiation offerings that they offer to their folks. There are occasional courses in the service academies. West Point has a sort of negotiation initiative. But could you comment generally on, you know, what's the state of negotiation training more broadly in the U.S. military, or perhaps just in the U.S. Army? Is there enough? Is it the right level? Is it too tactical? Is it too strategic? Do we need both? Any thoughts on negotiation training?
I'd just like to reiterate that our guest, Mr. Pruitt, is speaking on his own behalf and not on behalf of the United States Army or the United States government.
That's a timely reminder, particularly with this question. So I think the best approach to answering that question is just to sort of provide opinions on what I think would be valuable for U.S. soldiers to receive in with regard to negotiation training. And in my experience, and this was informed sort of in retrospect, I didn't consider it this way at the time, but throughout my deployments and my various interactions, particularly abroad, I've come to sort of look at it through the lens that pretty much everything is negotiations. All of your interactions with your foreign, your host, the other agencies that you're dealing with, the various chains of command within the military that you may be dealing with, it all forms some sort of negotiation. You're either laying a foundation for the shadow of the future, or you're directly trying to achieve some sort of goal through your interactions. And inevitably, even if the other parties are aligned with you, that alignment only goes so far. At some point, there are constraints or limitations that mean that pretty much everyone at some point is going to have a divergent view about what's happening. So I think just sort of creating, somehow facilitating that mindset of negotiations, because I think, and I when I first came into a negotiations course, my thought was sort of the stereotypical, all right, well, it's time to play hardball. I need to be prepared to really be
hit
tough,
hard.
And I need to, you know, I'm going to stick to my guns. I, you know, this is my position, and I'm not going to back down from my position. And that sort of mindset, which I think sort of accompanies the term negotiation, and I think that that's an unfair association at this point, you know, again, looking back. But I think that, mediation also, as if we could call that a subset of negotiation,
yeah, absolutely,
is incredibly critical for, particularly when we're not a party to a conflict, right? And I think that's an important distinction. A lot of the conversation is Iraq and Afghanistan, where we were parties to the conflict. But a lot of our most effective engagement abroad in uniform is when we are not a party to the conflict,
right.
And we are, you know, the uniform, the flag carries a lot of weight, and we can be very effective in a mediation role. When I was in Bosnia, the international community would consistently praise the U.S. military presence as the only group that was actually fulfilling its mandate, right? Providing that safe and secure environment. And, you know, we were mediating things on a daily basis.
Was this part of I-4 or S-4, the stability S-4, force?
S-4, yes. And it was, you really saw that your role as a representative of the U.S. government very clearly could make a difference.
Right.
And your ability to negotiate in that mediator role, even though it may have been a separate set of negotiations to get the two disagreeing factions to come together, it was incredibly important that you did that well. And I think that I learned a lot from the people who were actually conducting and leading those particular engagements about how to do it well. And then that served in other capacities. But I think that our soldiers at the various levels really need to sort of have a foundation of how to approach these conversations, how to approach these engagements, and to think about them not so much as negotiations in the stereotypical sense,
right,
but in their more actual sense. And another key point is that it's not rank specific.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think a lot of times, you know, that when you think of negotiations, you think about ambassadors,
right,
and things like that, very, very high level, you know, in the military terms, like colonels and above would be having these negotiations. But really, you know, General Krulak, the U.S. Marine Corps general, spoke about the strategic corporal. And when you are there on the ground, you are the representative of the U.S. government to the people there.
Right.
And whether you are a brand new private who is there, it's your first week in the military, or you're a 30-year veteran, they don't know the difference. Obviously, they can make assumptions, but having that sort of foundation, a shared foundation that is across the force, I think would be a valuable thing for whatever environment that the military is placed into.
Over a decade and a half ago, when the Middle East peace process was crumbling and Palestinians and Israelis went back to fighting, the Israelis had put a siege around Arafat's compound and another one in Bethlehem at the Church of the Nativity, where a number of Hamas and PLO fighters had taken refuge. And Peter and I have an acquaintance, a friend, who was on the Israeli side of a negotiation team trying to de-escalate the Church of the Nativity siege. And it struck me that he actually published his story as a journal article a few years later, Moti's article, on how he was there just to negotiate, even though he was an infantry officer as part of that, the Israel Defense Forces deployment in Bethlehem. He wasn't there to take part in combat operations. He was trying to look for a nonviolent solution to the siege. And it struck me that what he was doing was really mediating. He was mediating between his own side, between the IDF, who were on site and ready to shoot guys as they showed up at a window in the church, etc., but also a mediator among the religious community that was in the church that was sort of there voluntarily. I'm putting up my fingers in quotes, but there was some question as to whether they were being coerced by the fighters who had taken refuge in the church, and between the community of Palestinians living around that area, as well as the fighters themselves. So that was a really complicated, you know, mediation for someone. And he was Moti was a negotiation geek, if we can say the word, you know, really into negotiation issues. And he talks through how this was really ultimately resolved by some creative thinking rather than coercion. And they eventually found some ways to end it by using some community intermediaries to go back and forth, get the release of the religious community, separate out the fighters into different categories, some to be released, others to be detained by a U.S.-British facility in the north. So, you know, that this could have gone really badly for everybody, and you could have had, you know, the specter of the Israelis attacking a church, an old, a really ancient church, and it wasn't going to be good for anybody. You told me about a similar crisis mediation moment that always reminded me a little bit of this, but on a microcosmic level, that took place in El Salvador that also invoked the same set of skills. You have an emergent conflict between people, and you're the only one who sees it emerging and can do something about it. Why don't you share with our listeners that El Salvador story?
All right. Well, it was in, as you say, El Salvador, and we were a small presence there, and I was myself and a driver were sent to sort of oversee a humanitarian construction project in a part of El Salvador that saw a lot of heavy fighting during their conflicts, and the mayor of that area was a former rebel commander, and he still was very very much in that sort of rebel mindset. In fact, he had a gold chain necklace with an Uzi on it, sort of marking his less than urbane background, and he established the government center, for lack of a better term, and declared that was the seat of power for that little area.
His mayoralty, so to speak.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And so the government had declared that all government buildings were weapons-free zones and that it was against the law to carry a weapon into a government building. And we were working with the El Salvadorian military to facilitate this humanitarian project, building a school. And the El Salvadorian military personnel, as we were meeting with the military, they came in and they had their weapons on them. And the mayor reacted very, very violently to the fact that they had brought in their weapons, so called his guys with weapons into the building. And there quickly became a standoff with these guys threatening to shoot each other because they were not supposed to have the weapons. And so,
and there you were in the middle of it.
Quite literally, I was physically in between these two parties, just with my hands up, asking them to please reconsider their positions and to go back to a state of calm so that we could discuss the problems mm-hmm. that they had and try to work through them. So that was an interesting
Give
time.
Us a little bit of the sense of the flavor of it. I mean, you're probably you're a cool-headed guy. Maybe you didn't break a sweat, but I'd have been sweating bricks, as yeah. we used to say in Brooklyn, in that moment.
And I would add as well, Jesse, one of the things that we're going to emphasize in the course in the coming week is the cultural dynamics that are at play in negotiation. And Anthony will emphasize in his lectures that traditionally the focus on negotiation teaching was that culture was really not important, and that tone has changed completely, and said that there needs to be a focus on the cultural aspects of negotiation. So I'm wondering, based on your experience as a practitioner, if you were able to discern in the moment that a lot of this was, one, emotions, two, perhaps a macho attitude of former combatants who felt the need to assert themselves, three, a style of communicating which is perhaps indirect, and four, perhaps related to just stress of having gone through an extended conflict, and how that impacted your interpretation as an objective individual of what was actually at stake. Were you able to say, I think I can parse this into what we can work with and what we can negotiate and what are other dynamics at play? Or were you, like Anthony suggested, a lot of person would be just like, my goodness, this is about to get very violent very soon. What can you take us back to that moment?
Well, I was indeed sweating bricks or sweating bullets. Yeah. And so it was a very tense moment. I think in my particular case, you mentioned the cultural aspects, and I think that it was helpful that I had spent a bit of time in various Latin American settings, and I had also developed relationships with both of those parties prior to mm-hmm. that circumstance arising. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to sort of call on that and appeal to them, at least to buy time, while we sort of work through the consequences and what might result if the impulses took over. And but all of those things, again, at the time, this was I did not have any negotiation training or anything like that, so I didn't consider it a negotiation until later, when I formally studied negotiation. And It was, I think, in my particular circumstance, this particular circumstance, it was a very fortunate set of experiences that I had had previously that allowed the conversation that I was having to be relevant and heard in that particular setting. But I think that applying that to a broader scale, negotiation training and cultural awareness were both critical, or would be critical to someone else that might find themselves in a similar set of circumstances, if they were able to sort of think these things through beforehand and anticipate, well, if person X, who seems to be fairly volatile as this person was, I had sort of already war gamed, you know, how I might appeal to this person to have him calm down, not necessarily forecasting that particular set of circumstances, but just in general. I may need to reach this individual in some, you know, in some way. There may be some volatility involved. How will I reach this person? That sort of thought process had taken place prior already. To that, the conflict emerging. And so that it would have been more effective if I had had some formal sort of negotiation training that would have allowed me to think of it in that way.
But you succeeded. I mean,
well, it worked. Nobody shot anybody.
Yeah,
so.
That was success in that moment.
I would add that I found myself in similar circumstances. You mentioned that you were in Bosnia, and I spent some time in the Western Balkans as well. And I'm familiar with the cultural style of communication there, as well as sort of the impact of stress and trauma had on people. And years later, when I was in the UK doing some studies, I had a neighbor who was an asylum seeker, someone who wanted to be a refugee. But it was sort of pending his status from the government. He was a neighbor, and he was playing music very late at night. And I went over and I knocked on the door, and I asked him very politely, in a kind of the style that's common in the U.S. or Britain, can you please turn down the music? Whereupon he grabbed a knife and said, if you come back here again, I'll cut your throat. And having spent enough time in the Western Balkans and thinking I understood the context, I recognized the cultural dynamics that were at play and something was going on. And I took a chance. So first thing I did was take two steps back so that he wasn't actually within arm's reach of me. And then I threatened him. Then I said, you know, listen, you're going to threaten me. I have friends in the government here, and I'll get you deported. And, you know, then you'll be back home. And who knows what's going to happen to you then. And then he smiled and said, you know, I like you. You know, you want me to turn down my music? And I'm like, yeah, can you turn it down every night after 10? And afterwards, you know, I had a relationship with him. And it makes me think about what you're saying, is that sort of like you can use that leverage and you can use your knowledge of the cultural dynamics. It's also a good idea to take a step back, literally, in case someone, you know, is going to use violence, because we often don't know the impact of people when they've gone through such a situation that it stays with them. And we have to use caution, because our negotiation tactics or skills don't always account for that if we've been trained in the U.S. So with that idea of, you know, our training, I wanted to kind of put you on the spot, even more than we've put you on the spot, because we do regard you as a professional who has a lot of knowledge of negotiation, and wanted to just come to some basics, because you said you didn't regard yourself as a negotiator, for example, in El Salvador and some of your other roles, but I think we can say that you are a negotiator now with substantial knowledge. Since in our course this week we're talking a lot about tactical moves that we make in negotiation, tactical moves that help shape the outcome, we just wanted to ask you how you would think in terms of tactics as opposed to the larger strategy. So four questions, or maybe a little more than four. First is, how do you get prepared for any critical negotiation? Second is, do you try to influence what's going to be discussed before you get to the negotiating environment? Third is, do you try to build trust and establish your credibility with people? Meaning, you want them to know who you are before you get down to business. And what might you do? And last, what do you do when your counterpart claims to be unable to carry out what you've asked of them, if they claim to be powerless? So what leverage in negotiation do you bring? What can you help them to do what you want to do? So those are not easy questions, but we believe you have some wisdom to invoke.
That's quite a list, Peter. So let's see. The first one
we're
was,
going easy on.
preparing for negotiation. So if you know that you're going into an environment, and again, trying to define this as not a strict, I am about to negotiate, but instead I'm going to engage, mm-hmm. And it's going to be a critical engagement, then you certainly want to arm yourself with as much knowledge as you can about that particular individual that you might be dealing with, what their relationships are, what are some of the things that are important to them that you might call upon. How can you assist them? What are ways that you might hurt them if things that you're negotiating, that you're talking about, if they don't go the way that you want them to go, how will this impact that person's situation? I think that's a very powerful tool that sort of, and I think that talks about kind of leverage, one of your later questions. If you can sort of understand what their environment is, you can sort of help understand how you are going to impact that environment, either positively or negatively. It doesn't have to be sort of in terms of threats or a negative thing, but it's just if you're thirsty and you have water, you know, we need to work out an agreement if we're going to find a way for me to give you the water that I have. Mm-hmm. It's not nefarious or underhanded, as a lot of times I think negotiations are kind of crafted into, well, you have to be devious and you have to fool the other person and you have to pull the wool over their eyes in order to be successful. And I don't think that's the case. In fact, trust and credibility, I think that the vast majority of the times I've been involved in any sort of meaningful engagement with a counterpart, we've always been very forthright and open. I've found that if you try to be, you know, too sly or too fancy, it catches up with you, mm-hmm. and then everything else is harder to do. And I know that we've found that one of the things with the rotations is others may not have shared that view, and they were very kind of sneaky and sly, and so we had to overcome the fact that our predecessors were kind of operated in that mode, and so in order for us to be effective, we had to overcome that and had to demonstrate even more our willingness to be honest brokers and that we were legitimate when we said the things that we said. And that's not trying to be overly friendly, trying focusing on being nice or anything, just like saying it how it is, right? Mm-hmm. Things that you can do, things that you can't do, things that you will do.
Things that you can do, things that you can't do, things that you will do. I like that. Mm-hmm. And what about the supposedly powerless counterpart who you suspect might be able to actually say yes and commit and implement, but who claims not to be able to?
Well, this is where the power of the uniform sort of comes into play, mm-hmm. right? Because they sort of understand instinctively after a certain period of time that you do have a certain amount of power. And so if they claim to be powerless, you can claim to be powerless as well, right? And then all of a sudden you're kind of at a stalemate of powerlessness, and they still want to get whatever it is that they're trying to get.
So they become powerful. Giving,
and then so then they tend to yield on that. Well, perhaps I can actually do perhaps I might be able to influence a little bit, right? And so they start to yield.
Sort of admit a little bit of ability to do something.
Yes, because when you kind of throw that back on, when your power is obvious and evident, but then you say, oh, sorry, I don't have the ability to do that. Mm. When clearly you do, it kind of shows them that you're onto their game.
I like that. I like that. That is very tactical, in fact. And a lot of good negotiation sometimes comes down to improvisationally choosing a particular set of tactics that are appropriate to the moment and the context and the people.
And I would add, it's also interesting tactically, because a lot of interesting work that's done in a peace-building field is about reframing. And I use reframing to distinguish from rebranding. Rebranding means giving something a new name. Reframing is a little bit different. It's not just giving something a new name, because people often can see through that. It's basically showing them a different perspective and asking them to work with you to define that perspective in a way that helps them and helps you. So I like this suggestion of yours based on your experience. I think it turns the table but also makes people feel empowered at the same time, which is to your credit, and maybe we can name it after you for the future. So our time is coming to a close. And I would like to thank Jesse Pruitt for being with us today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Again, our guest has been Mr. Jesse Pruitt. Our producers are Leah Cullens, Vanessa Francis, Kara Stevens, and myself, Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Blake Mobley. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. I've been your guest host, Peter Weinberger. Next week, our regular host, Darren Cambridge, returns from sunny New Orleans. Today's co-host has been Dr. Anthony Juanese St. John. Thanks to all our listeners, and tune in again next week.